Welcome to Discovery 1, Semester 1, Module 9. And today we're going to talk about troubleshooting. This is the same type of stuff that we're going to talk about tomorrow in ITE 1, except this is going to be more network-focused, whereas the ITE 1 is more focused on individual PCs. We'll be talking about troubleshooting routers, access points, and cables, and their networks. Okay. People rely on their networks 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Because of this, when a network goes down, it is important to get it back up as soon as possible so that people can get on with whatever they need to do. Has anyone else ever had their network go down for an extended period of time?
Has anyone not?
Okay. Well, Drew, when your network went down for a long time, what happened? What did you do?
He got very drunk.
I cried, and then went to watch television.
Were you very productive?
No. I'm really productive even when my network is up, but that's not...
Well, then you don't count. Last year, I had my network go down for 2 days. And since I was studying online at the time, and I work online, I could do just about nothing. So I seriously slept a lot, and ate a lot, and really, it was pretty ridiculous because I was not productive at all. And when the network finally did come back, I was scrambling to catch up with stuff, trying to get all my email done, and looking at all the money I could have made in those 2 days, and the opportunities that I couldn't take because I wasn't online, and that made me very, very sad. That's just me. I'm one person. Drew's one
now,
person.
Now, has it ever occurred to anybody that us blind people are disgustingly reliant on the internet, and if ever the internet goes down, you're going to have a lot of very bored blind people walking the streets?
Nothing is worse than that.
So Grace can make that much money out of Matrix mail, can she?
All sorts of stuff. It was much more lucrative in America, and I really did miss out on some decent money for being offline for 2 days.
Yeah, in Australia, the survey scene isn't anywhere near as profitable. I mean, she did manage to get a $25 gift card from Woolies or whatever, but
Woolies,
boy.
Yeah. I make some money. It's just not near as much as I did in the States.
Do you know Australians that you can work at home and receive $1,000 a month?
Just no, you can't.
Work at home at Comcast.net.
No, you can't.
Then give them your account number, and they'll charge you $50, but it's all worth it in the end.
Actually... Well, that's
actually,
a whole different
topic. If you give us your account number, Drew, we will certainly empty your account for you in the benefit of Cavi. Just send it through. And
I'll be making all that money back when I get the degree.
Yeah, we're based in Nigeria, by the way. And, Drew, by the way, you've just won the Nigerian lottery. All you have to do is give me your bank account details so that I can put the money into your account.
Okay, sweet. That's a good deal. Nothing unsuspicious about this. I don't know what lottery it is and haven't entered any lotteries, but I trust you.
Oh, you're but you have. We just found your name at random.
You wouldn't give me an email if you weren't a good person.
That's true. Why would I have
the time?
I only
give my email to good people.
Anyway.
And can I use the money to buy a Ukrainian wife? I don't know what
absolutely,
my sister would say.
Because, you know, those Russian brides are much more gentle than the American and European brides.
Okay, customer service.
To good people. I only give my email address to good people and safeway.com, so I trust.
Okay. So, that's just me. We're bored blind people, and at the moment, a lot of us aren't working. Imagine what havoc it's going to wreak on a business if their network goes down for 2 days. How much money are they going to lose? And what are their employees going to do besides make paper airplanes and throw them?
That's assuming if they don't have a paperless office.
Fair enough.
And they took the internet course on how to fold paper crane.
Yep. Okay. Experienced techs often use instinct to troubleshoot, but there are structured ways of doing this as well. And if you are not very experienced at troubleshooting, these can really help make your life a whole lot easier when working with network troubleshooting. We've got three popular methods, and these are in your test. You have to identify which method is used. We've got bottom-up, top-down, and divide and conquer. Remember the seven layers of the OSI model? Does anyone want to have a go at what the seven layers are? Or even the first layer from the bottom-up of the OSI reference model?
Application layer.
The bottom-up.
You're going top-down, but that's okay.
Yes.
You want to have a go, Paul? All right.
Yes, Grace, I would.
Go for it.
What did you say?
Go ahead.
Seven layers of the OSI reference model.
Yes. It would be top, bottom, down would be.
Bottom, we need to go bottom up.
Starting at the very bottom, it would be.
Mm-hmm.
It would be. Physical.
Yeah.
Bottom up. Application.
No, you're doing it right.
Application is the first one.
Oh, we're delayed.
It is.
No. Application is the top of the OSI reference model, Paul. Physical is at the bottom. Application is at the top.
Okay, well, you want bottom up, right?
That's right. So we're starting from the bottom and going up.
All right. It would be physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application.
Well done.
Good job. That's awesome.
Now you all should be able to do that. Okay, so next week I'm going to ask some other random students. I want everybody to know their OSI reference model. You have to know their seven layers. You should be able to go physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application, or application, presentation, session, transport, network, data link, physical. Either way, you should know all these seven layers. Very important.
And that means Paul's going to get a few questions right on his final without even trying.
So there you go.
All right, so we've done the reference model. If you need more information on what these layers do, refer to Module 5, because we've got a lot to cover today. We'll talk a little bit about it in regards to troubleshooting, but we're not going to go back over that today.
It's actually Module 6.
Is it?
Actually Module 6, sorry. Yes.
Fair enough. So Paul listed these from bottom to top. This is very important because you need to know which way they go because it asks you in your test. So the bottom one is physical, the top is application. The very middle one is networking, and that is very important. A bottom-up approach to troubleshooting, you're going to start at the physical layer, checking things such as cables being undamaged, or properly connected, and properly connected. What is the status of the LED lights if you can see them, or have a friendly neighborhood sighted person, or a light probe, or color detector, because you're going to need it all.
Just a point here, if you don't have a light probe, and you don't have a color detector, perhaps you would like to download a copy of Seeing with Sound, www.seeingwithsound.com. If you have a Symbian mobile phone, this has a color detector, a light probe, and all sorts of cool stuff in it, and it's free, and blind people like free stuff. Actually, it runs on any Java-compliant mobile device, so seeingwithsound.com.
And it is the trippiest thing, seriously. Have a play with it.
I only caught the word free out of that, so I'm interested.
Seeingwithsound.com.
I think he was kidding. Okay, you also need to check if the network card is properly seated. And make sure that your antenna on the back of your wireless card, if we're working with wireless, is properly screwed on, that might be a problem. If that entire layer is fine, you go up the OSI model until you find the problem. So you're going to go and check the network, or the data link network, so on. The top-down approach is exactly the opposite. You're going to start at the application layer, checking things such as whether the internet browser or email applications are able to access the internet, and you're going to move down all the way down to the physical layer if necessary. And once you listen to somebody describe the problem, you're going to probably have an idea of which end you want to start at. If you don't, you're going to use the divide and conquer method, which starts somewhere in the middle, such as at the network layer, checking TCP/IP connectivity. And that's what I usually do. What was that?
I think some... No, somebody disconnected, I think, did they?
Oh, fair enough.
I tend to kind of go from both ends and meet in the middle. Like a bit. Okay, can I use the internet? Sorry.
Actually, I came in.
Oh, okay. Oh, hello, Rose.
Lobby.
Sorry. I just didn't hear.
Of course we can be.
Because we're...
Basically.
Fair enough, I guess.
Okay. That's not the best idea of how to do it. You're going to want to listen to what people say and then decide where you're going to start. And if you don't know, you want to probably start in the middle and... check the TCP/IP settings so that you can decide which way you want to go first.
Also, if you're having trouble with wireless connectivity yet the wired connectivity is fine, it probably doesn't make sense to start messing with the application layer and work your way down, because you can be pretty sure that the problem is in the physical or the data link. And there's a big sigh from Grace.
Oh, sorry. Many technicians bypass these methods and use trial and error or substitution of a known good component, but if you have little experience or really no clue what the problem might be, these methods can give you a good start. You don't want to use trial and error if you can't use educated trial and error. So you want to really examine what you're doing and make sure you have a good idea of what the problem is before you just start trying random stuff. When troubleshooting, it is very important to keep good documentation. Document the problem, document the steps you took that did not work, and steps that led to a resolution of the problem. It is important to document these things to the best of your ability so that if the problem happens again in your life as a technician, you can look back at your documents and solve it quickly. Now, the reason you want to document the steps that did not work is because if you ever encountered this problem again, you have an instant record of what didn't work, so you're going to be much faster at solving the problem. You don't have to try all of those steps. The very first thing you can try is the steps that actually work to solve the problem. Now, if those don't work, you may have a different problem. But 9 times out of 10, you'll probably be able to just solve the problem right away. This saves your customers time and money and makes you a really good technician that they actually want to have back. Any questions on that and documentation?
Yeah, how do you index the journals or logs or whatever you call them so that you can access, you say, oh, 2 months ago I had something similar, what did I do?
There's actually that depends on the technician. There's actually a number of ways of doing it. One of them is to index them on a short problem description and then sort them into subcategories such as network, hardware, specific devices, that sort of thing. There was a guy who had a really good setup, who had a good way of laying them out. I think he called them the captain's logs, and it was how he kept track of what was going on his server. So he had them indexed based on the server day, then he had them indexed based on the software and the versions and that sort of thing. So what you would do is you'd probably come up with classifications that make sense for you. Networks, hardware, software, driver issue. And then if you're having a trouble with one of those, you can then look through your files and go, okay, what sort of problems did I have on this previously with drivers? Ah, this looks similar.
And did this fellow use Stardate rather than the normal year?
As a matter of fact, he did. And I can't imagine why.
That is dorky.
That was the American.
Probably not. You know, if it were me, and I was working for starting my own business, I'd probably find some kind of web-based journaling or blogging software, keep it private, and make it searchable.
That's true. Could you, like, put them in a database? That'd be very useful.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I also have on my BrailleSense Plus a database program, and that would be another idea, but I definitely want it searchable. So.
You probably have trouble coming up with a good entity relationship model and stuff on the database. There is actually open source help desk management software such as Track and various other bits of information, and if you were really serious about this, you'd probably have a look at what was out there to be able to set up a really good help desk management system.
Okay, we're going to talk about the troubleshooting process. So, hey guys, in ITE1, this is not the same troubleshooting process you're used to. They expect that you already kind of have a common sense idea of how the troubleshooting process works, and that you can figure a lot of this out. So we're not going over the 7 steps of troubleshooting here. You don't have to memorize the 7 steps of troubleshooting for discovery.
6.
Because they figure you're... 6, is it? Okay, 7 layers of the OSI reference model. You don't have to do that. It's all good. They expect you already to have a lot of this down. Alright, so the first thing you want to do before you get into the troubleshooting process is verify the problem and determine how bad it actually is. When people's networks go down, they are in a panic. So they may make the problem out to be worse than it is. You need to talk to, talk to the customer and see what's actually happening after you calm them down. Talk to the people that reported the problem as well as other affected users. You want to see if there are other affected users. If they're working in an office, you want to see if the person in the next cubicle might actually be having the same problem. So then you know if this is an isolated issue, probably on the computer that they are working on, or if this is actually an office-wide or area-wide issue. You want to ask questions such as, what error messages did you receive, if any? Have any changes been made to the workstation involved recently? Can you tell me the symptoms of the problem from your perspective? Once you've talked to the customer, you want to gather information about the affected devices. Get the model number of the device, then go online and look up as much information about the device as you can find. So if you're suspecting that the router is going to be the problem, after you've checked the cables and all of that, you want to get the model number of the router, put it into Google, find the website of the manufacturer, get manuals, see if there's any kind of forums. See if anyone's had the same problem before. Make sure to get any recent logs if the device provides them. Many routers do. And many programs do as well if it's on the software side.
Now, just a quick point here. Has anybody been into the event viewer under Windows? Lots of stuff in there, and sometimes that can be quite insightful.
Yes, I have been in there.
All right. If you haven't been in there, you probably should have a look around.
There was something very useful, and I'm failing because I can't remember where to find it, but there are programs that exist that can be quite useful, which will, like Blue Screen Viewer or something, and they're utilities that will basically take the information that you get. If you get a stop error that causes you to, get a forced restart of your computer, then it'll look in where that is, and then it'll show you what driver. It'll basically read the blue screen error that you had out for you in Windows so that you can actually read it yourself and figure out where the problem is.
The Dr. Watson 32 can do that as well, and that's part of Windows.
I may actually, since you guys can't do any of these labs in Module 9 at this point, I may actually write up a lab where you do a few things with troubleshooting problems and decide which troubleshooting problems might require which software. I don't know if I will. I'll talk to Carrie about it, but that may happen because the labs that we have, pretty much you need somebody else to come break your networks. And while I'd love to fly around to everybody's house and break their networks for them and all that, I really can't do that.
Hey, I'll
so
do that.
So that lab won't work. Yeah, the money's the problem. So you want to find out what software and or firmware the device is running to check for compatibility problems. One of the most common types of network problems is a physical problem. Physical problems only concern hardware such as routers and ICs and cables. Only the stuff you can touch and manipulate with your hands. Obviously, use your senses of touch, smell, hearing, and sight, if you have any, to determine these problems. Examples include a cable that came unplugged. You can feel that. You can also feel if the clip has snapped off your RJ45 cable. You can smell the smoke pouring out of a router if you've plugged in the wrong cable. That's a problem.
I've never had that happen.
I haven't either.
Is it possible?
Smoke pouring out of a router?
Oh, I have.
Yes, because of the wrong cable.
No, that can do it. But the other thing that can... sometimes if you plug an ISDN cable into a regular modem, it's got like about 48 volts on the cable, and that will tend to bang modems, and smoke will go pouring out. So if you plug into the wrong phone socket, you'll bang it. The other thing you can have is sometimes power supplies will blow up. If you get a power surge or you just got a shoddy switch mode, they will tend to go bang, and the smoke will come out of them.
I had that happen. I was sitting on my... Go ahead.
I recently had that happen to a hard drive that I had. Somebody plugged the wrong adapter and it blowed up the hard drive.
Oh, bad.
That sucks. I was sitting on my bed in the States. I had just bought a seriously $10 adapter for my laptop computer off of eBay. And I'm sitting there charging it up and I hear this bang. I'm like, I have no idea what that was. And I'm looking on the floor because it comes from the floor, and I pick up this switch mode, and there's smoke pouring out of it. It's not on fire or anything, but it's such as this awful burnt plastic smell. I'm like, oh, I think I fried that one.
Interestingly enough, my brother had a fire in his computer one day. And his girlfriend sort of woke him up and said, Dan, there's a fire in your computer. And he's like, yeah, whatever. And she's like, no, there really is a fire in your computer. And he went and had a look at it. And sure enough, there was a fire in his computer. His good old Gigabyte board had caught fire and it was burning away.
Hey, they really have blazing fast transfer rates. A very good way to turn your computer into a flamethrower, spray compressed air in it while it's...
Have you done this?
No.
Okay, I was going to say.
If you have the computer to waste and,
Actually, no, because if you do that and the flames go back into the can and it explodes, we will be down a student and we will all hold you liable. So please do not do that, people. We are not going for the Darwin Awards on here.
No. That'd be mostly for sighted people because, then they can look at the flames, but yeah.
That's for nobody. That's such a bad idea. seriously, that is a really, really bad idea.
It's a terrible idea. It's a very bad idea, but it's very impressive.
So, do something more productive with your computers if you actually want to waste computers. Send them over here. We can probably use them for parts.
Yeah. I'd be bored.
Okay. Yeah, and safe. We don't want you to lose a hand
and
worse.
Save lives. Yeah, that's
Okay. The things that don't go boom. Software. We'll discuss software utilities that can be used to troubleshoot network problems. All of these are available in most operating systems, including Windows. There are 5 utilities we will discuss.
I love the way they say it that way. Most software, including Windows, as if Windows wouldn't necessarily have them by default.
Why not? You never know. Well, then, you know what? I think they're trying to save me from answering questions. Well, including Windows 2? Yeah. There we go.
Most
just
software, including
that.
Windows, does not explain.
No. Okay. Each can be
Even
run
Windows
by. Each can be run from the command line in Windows by going to run. And what are we going to type into the run dialog box to make the command prompt run, guys?
CMD.
That is absolutely right. And then we're going to press enter.
Is anybody
Good
else
job,
apart
Paul.
From Drew and Paul awake?
I was
no.
I was going to say CMD, but he said it, and so I just shut up.
Okay,
you are super quiet.
Oh, am I?
Now we can hear you.
All right. So we're going to have, because I know we went over some of this before, and I'm just going to pick your brains, and we're going to talk about these commands. So I'm going to ask people, and we're going to go in turn. So if you've answered a question last, you can't answer until, you know, give other people a couple chances to answer. All right, first one is ipconfig. It answers the questions. Do I have the right IP address, subnet mask, and default gateway? To see information about your computer's IP address, subnet mask, and default gateway, as well as many other useful things, what would we type into the command prompt? Anyone?
CMD.
That is right. ipconfig/all. And assume that we're at the command prompt for these already. I don't know that we went over this. To release your IP address information back to the DHCP server, type in ipconfig/release. Now, when you do this, realize that you will not be able to do anything on your network until you renew your IP address information by typing ipconfig/renew.
Can anybody tell me why you would need to release your IP address? Anybody think of a scenario where you would need to release your IP address? No, Drew, we've heard enough from you today. You're not answering.
I'm thinking in a situation where your internet is not functioning properly.
Yes, that's certainly one situation. Yeah. The other one would also be if you have a 169.254 address. Can anybody tell me what a 169.254 address is? You're still blocked from answering. True.
It's your local Windows IP.
No, not quite.
Close.
Private.
Yeah.
Automatic private address.
IP address allocation, a PIPA. Yes.
Good.
They
job.
Are the addresses that are automatically assigned to your network card by Windows when the DHCP server is uncontactable. Usually by Windows. There is actually a thing for Linux that'll do it as well. 169.254 and then two octets which are hashed from your card's MAC address.
Oh, it's yours. Okay. Now, during this release/renew has saved me...
I was just going to tell Drew he can start answering questions again now.
you're not banned anymore. We're just giving everybody a chance to go at it. Go ahead.
I was wondering, and this may be dumb, I was wondering if there's a particular reason why release and renew are two separate commands, since you pretty much have to do the second one after you do the first one for anything else.
Because you might not want to renew the address straight away, because the network administrator might have said, release your IP address, and while he's messing with the DHCP server configuration, you are not to renew it yet.
Oh. Good question, because I've thought that too. So this thing has saved me from being without internet so many times. It's like the, have you turned it on and off again in IT crowd?
Now, has anybody else been into the section of Windows? This is a GUI way of doing it, just in case you're into that sort of thing, where you press enter on the network control, where you press Alt enter on My Network Places, enter on the network card, and then you control tab across to the support tab, and it's got like the fix this button or the troubleshoot button or whatever it's called. Anybody played with that?
Doesn't always work though. Like it'll tell me that it was unable to fix the problem, but then you'll go on the internet.
Yeah, I agree.
Ah, yes, but have you ever actually looked at the log and seen why it couldn't fix the problem?
Yep.
It creates a lot.
Well, there's actually a list of things in the dialog box when you run it that says that it tells you the steps it went through and why it couldn't fix the problem. And the reason happens is because there are actually things that it can't fix because obviously the problem is somewhere else and it requires user intervention to fix it.
And to be fair, the one in XP kind of, you know, isn't as cool. The one in 7 is pretty excellent.
Yeah. Also, you can renew and release your IP on your router. Yeah, no.
No, you're releasing and renewing a different IP. Your release. Yeah. What IP do you think you're going to release and renew on a router, guys?
Keep in mind there is a difference between releasing and renewing the IP address on your workstation and releasing and renewing the IP address on your router.
Yeah.
So,
what do you think you do when you do it on your router?
Yeah, if you release it on the router, you're releasing your WAN IP, your public IP.
You're releasing it from the ISP. So just keep that in mind. Those are two different problems, and they'll fix two different sets of issues. So right now, at this moment, we're talking about just doing it on the individual workstation. Okay. The next utility we are going to talk about is ping. The question it answers is, can I send an IP packet to another host? And what are we going to do to use the ping command? We are at the command prompt, and anyone can answer this. So the buffer is reset. If you want to answer, go ahead.
Yes, you can type ping, and then what? Yes, we have a ping, www.example.com from Taylor.
Awesome.
And sadly, I think that even works. There is an example.com.
For real? Okay. You can also ping an IP address of a server or a machine. So if you have two machines, you can actually try and ping the other machine.
That actually does work. If you open a command prompt, ping www.example.com, 192.0.whatever. So there you go, working example, everybody.
When a ping is sent to an IP address, a packet known as an echo request is sent across the network to the IP address specified. If the destination host receives the echo request, it responds with a packet known as an echo reply. If the source receives the echo reply, connectivity is verified. So in Windows, it's going to send 4 packets of 8 bytes each, and you are going to get 4 packets back of 8 bytes each. And if you get all 4 packets back, you've got 100% connectivity.
Actually, the outbound packet has 56 bytes on the outbound packet and 64 bytes on the receive packet, which means that it's not an 8-byte packet because you've still got to have the source IP address, the destination IP address, the source MAC, the destination MAC, the CRC, all the other bits in the packet. So, yeah, they're not 8-byte packets. I don't know where that came from.
Okay.
And yes, there is a www.example.com. There is also an example.net and an example.org, and they cite RFC 2600.
Fair enough. So if a ping is sent to a name such as www.cisco.com, it is first sent to the DNS server to resolve an IP address. Once the IP address is obtained, the echo request is forwarded to the IP address, and the process proceeds. If a ping to the IP address succeeds, but a ping to the name does not, there's most likely a problem with DNS. Any questions on ping? All right, cool. So we'll go on to the third utility. We will talk about netstat. The question it answers is, what are my active network connections, and which TCP and UDP ports are in use? To use this command, I don't think we've gone over this, so I'll just say we type in netstat. This can tell you if there are ports open that shouldn't be. A more useful way to use this application is to type in /-b, so you can actually see which applications are using which ports. That's going to be a whole lot more helpful. And you should actually try this on your computers. If I write up a lab, that's going to be part of one thing that you're going to have to do, because it's just cool to see. So there you go. Any questions on that?
It's actually a little bit horrifying to use netstat when you've got a bunch of torrents going, because you can see everybody's IP who's connecting to you, and you like you can know exactly who they are.
Not really.
Yeah, but it's easy to do that from the peers tab of MuTorrent too, because it does all the reverse DNS mapping for you automatically.
Yeah,
and there's actually an option on that to copy them to the clipboard so you can paste them somewhere else.
Like an email.
Wow.
To an internet service provider.
Something like that.
Makes mental note next time I see Drew's IP address on my torrent peers list to email it to his ISP.
I would never. Oh, I see.
The fourth utility we will discuss is TraceRoute. This looks really, really crazy in American Braille. When you see TraceRoute, that is TraceRoute. It just looks really crazy, but that's what it is. Most of the time, we write it out as TraceRoute because we don't use contractions over syllables, but some Braille displays don't realize this. The questions it answers is, what route will my packets take to another host, and how much delay will there be at each hop? To use this command, does anybody know what we're going to do?
Yes. It's
okay, go ahead.
You type at the command line prompt, you type in Windows, it's TraceRoute.
That is right. And then what do?
Then you put in the web address that you want to find the traceroute for.
So Paul, do we put that right up against TraceRT, or do we want a space?
You want a space.
Space. We do space, want a space after that. TraceRT.
It's very important,
yes,
when we talk about typing commands into the command line that we specify whether there's a space or not, because one space is the difference between it working and not working.
Does anybody else get absolutely annoyed when you're trying to tell people to do something at the command line, and then if you pause for like half a second too long, they've belted the enter key?
I used to be one of those people that did that.
Sorry, what's the problem with doing that?
The problem is I might have told you half the command and I haven't finished the rest of the command, and if you keyed in half the command I've given you in the Linux, you'll have blown away every file in your home directory. So don't press enter until I tell you to.
No, sir.
Yeah, so it's very important to be very, very specific when giving your command line commands. You tell people when to press enter, you tell them when to press space, and when you're working with somebody who is giving you commands to type into the command line, expect them to do this.
Yeah, so say for example I'd say, you know, /rm /rf /, and then I was about to say /stuff, but you pressed enter after the slash, you'd wipe out every file on your file system. So very important to know when to press the enter.
and that's your fault, by the way, for not telling them to press enter at that.
No, no, that's your fault for not listening to the rest of the command.
Customer's all.
Nah.
Okay, so in retail, the customer is always right. In computer tech support, the customer is not always right, but you have to make them feel good about it.
They'll insist they didn't touch anything.
They always do.
Mm-hmm. And you say that's okay.
Press that return.
It's probably not your fault. But next time, in the future, just remember this, and that will keep any future problem, or that will keep this problem from occurring, or should keep this problem from occurring. And then you have shifted the blame from them, and all that good stuff. We'll talk a whole lot about that in ITE1. You can also put in an IP address of any server you want to trace route to.
I was just going to point out very quickly that we are looking on track for providing CS201, the Linux course, next semester.
Yay! I'll be in that class.
Excellent.
This can tell you where a packet may be slowed down in the transmission. By default, traceroute will only trace 30 hops. To change this number, type traceroute RT space dash H, and then you're going to type in the number of desired hops, hit space, then the host or IP or URL, the host IP or URL.
Can anybody tell me, does anybody have any ideas why traceroute defaults to 30 hops, even though this is a historic limitation? Because historically, on the internet, when it was a lot smaller than it is today, any destination that was over 30 hops away was considered unreachable.
That's crazy. Oh, and I just spilled coffee all over my face. There we go.
How often do you actually need more than 30 hops these days?
You do.
So often.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. There are some where you go route in and out of ISPs and through VPNs and stuff. You can actually quite easily exceed the 30 hop count.
So basically, you'll know if it's more than 30 hops by if it gets to hop 30 and it's still not.
And it hasn't gotten there yet.
Done.
Yeah. So we might want to put in 50 or so.
Now, there's a nice explanation of traceroute in one of the labs that you do that explains how it works. So if you haven't read that lab, make sure you read it. It talks about the TTLs and that sort of thing in that lab.
I think that's in 3. It's in 3.
Yeah, but it's also in one of the labs. Like, it actually says in one of the labs.
I know. That's in a lab in 3.
I think it's a 4 lab, because that's also the one where they do all the...
it is the 1-4 lab that you guys can do.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, tool is... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Grace. Just putting in the dash H and the number, that just basically sets the limit limitation for the number of hops?
That's correct.
And if you want to know what other funky switches, you can do a traceroute space dash question mark space greater than I am a blind person and like to read in notepad.txt. And then you can open that file in Notepad, and you could call it something shorter, of course. And you'd be able to open that file and read the help screen.
You can do that for most command lines.
You can. You can do that with traceroute, ping, IP config. So if you redirect the output into a text file, it makes it easier for you to review it at your leisure.
I came across a document that was dated 1999, and it had all these command line prompts. Is that still valid, or have they added new ones
or
taken ones away? Or
a lot of them are still valid. The command prompt hasn't changed too much.
Actually, there's a really good book, and I'm not sure where you get it from because my source isn't kosher, but it's called Administering Windows XP Server 2003, 2000, and 2008 from the command line, and the whole book is relevant to how you do command line administration across these operating systems and why you'd want to do so. And in fact, as a blind person, some of the only ways you can actually interact sanely with Active Directory are through the command line. So if you are doing Server 2008 administration and stuff, it's worth knowing about.
Oh, thanks for that little tip, Carrie. Thank you for that little tip.
That's all right.
Yeah, there's quite a few situations where
that saves you. That saved me so much time, dumping into Notepad.
Yeah, I've found many situations where it's actually more complicated to use a GUI than to just type in a command.
Yeah, especially with network, playing with network and network troubleshooting.
Now, does everybody know how to do that with the left-facing crocodile, or do I need to type it into chat? Because you will use this so much in your labs. And for those of you who have not created the 3 and 4 labs, I'm not looking at anybody in particular, but if you're listening to this recording, you should be feeling suitably guilty by now. You will need to use these greater than symbols, or the left-facing crocodile. Okay? Greater than is shift and full stop.
And if I write a lab, we'll put in how to do that in that lab, so that everybody has a... has that documentation.
Resist the urge to sing schnappy, 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 das kleines Krokodil.
Okay. NSLookup is our fifth and final tool. It answers the question, what is the IP address of whatever host name I type in? To use this, we type in nslookup space and then any host name. So nslookup space www.hucat.org.
You can also run this command in interactive mode by not providing a host name. And there are all sorts of funky commands in there, which you would have seen in one of the labs if you had done it with the DNS stuff.
Okay. Obviously, problems can occur on wired, wireless, and NICs networks. The easiest way to see which portion of your networks are affected is to ping the default gateway using a wired computer, then ping it again using a wireless device. Then, ping a wired device on your network from your wireless machine to verify local connectivity. If one works and not the other, only the one that doesn't work has the networking problem. So if you can ping from your wired PC to your default gateway on your router, and you can't from the wireless, your wireless segment is the problem. If you can get up to the internet, but you cannot ping from your from a wireless computer to a wired computer and get network connectivity that way, there's probably a firewall on one of them, and you might want to check that and turn it off. Or networking is not set up properly on one of the computers.
We had a student back in 2007 who will remain nameless, but the snarky messages are still in the list archives, that was told repeatedly to check whether they had a firewall enabled on their computer. And they said, no, I don't. And about 3 weeks later, it turned out that, yes, he did. And he's like, but I didn't know it had been installed by Dell. And we're like, well, not our problem. You should have looked in ad remove programs. It was quite a violent exchange, actually, but we did sort it out eventually. And it was his software firewall that was stopping his file sharing dead in its tracks.
Oops. All right. If they don't both work, it's probably your modem or router is not configured correctly, or your ISP's network may possibly be down. If the local connectivity tests fail, check to see if your computers are configured properly, then check the router configurations. And we talked about how to do that previously. Okay, so we're going to quickly go over LEDs, and this is important for you guys to know. Please remember that LEDs can fail, but this doesn't happen often. So we're going to assume that usually the LEDs have not failed and they are reporting accurately. We've got three types of LEDs commonly found on devices. We've got a power status and activity. Inactive LEDs may be an indication of device failure, port failure, or cabling issues. It is possible that the device is non-functioning due to faulty hardware. The port itself might also have become faulty due to hardware or improperly configured software. Regardless of whether the network is wired or wireless, verify that device and ports are up and functional before spending large amounts of time trying to troubleshoot other issues. So, lights on the router and modem do vary, but here are some things that are usually true. When you're working with a device, do make sure to check the documentation for the device in order to know exactly what the LEDs mean. We've got the security LED. This indicates the current condition of security settings on the device, whether WPA or WEP or automatic security is enabled. Solid green indicates that security is enabled. Now, if you don't see a solid green light on this, this doesn't mean that security is not enabled. It just means that possibly it's automatic built-in, we secure your network easy for you, is disabled. You may have, or someone else may have enabled security on it, and that green light may or may not show up. We've got the activity LEDs, wireless, internet, or Ethernet. These are sometimes referred to as link lights. An activity LED is normally associated with a specific port. Now, the normal condition is to flash, indicating that traffic is flowing through the port. You wouldn't think so. You'd think it'd be solid, and flashing would mean that something's wrong, right? Well, not here. When it's flashing green, that means that the traffic is flowing through. And on some devices, the rate of flashing indicates the speed that the ports are operating. A solid green indicates that a device is plugged into the port, but no traffic is flowing. So solid green means that traffic is not flowing, and something might actually be wrong, or that there's just no traffic flowing and that computer is actually idle. The flashing green, of course, means that it is receiving, the device is plugged in and receiving traffic. Amber indicates that the device is making adjustments to the way the port is operating. And no light, of course, means that nothing is plugged into the port that the router can detect, or there's an issue with the wired or wireless connection.
Some routers also have multicolor LEDs, so you've got green, orange, and red, and depending on the color and stuff of the LED, can also depend on what speed the link's at and stuff. And it can be quite complicated. There's a little table in the book that nobody ever looks at because it's just, yeah, whatever.
That's what I was just going to say. Remember that these can definitely vary, and you want to look at the manual or the website of the equipment manufacturer. The power LED usually is a solid green color. It indicates the power to the device. No light indicates a problem with the power or that your adapter has just slipped out and it's time to plug your router in. So we want to check the power connections. Do we have any questions about the LEDs?
I had an experience where I asked somebody I'm related to, is that green? And they said no. And I said, well, what color is it? And they said emerald. Give us a break.
No, that's green.
That was, and he was wrong too. It wasn't emerald, it was taupe.
It's funny how people have different perceptions of colors, and you'll get different answers on what colors are depending on which person you ask and what color they decide it is. And you sometimes get some people going, oh yes, that's cyan. And you go, oh, come on.
Yeah, I had someone once ask me what green looked like to me, and I just said, what does green look like to you? And they had no hand.
Yeah, fair enough. That's always one of the annoying blindy questions. Okay, also something, if you work with somebody who is colorblind, you just might want to keep that in mind. My dad helps me with a lot of LEDs and whatever. My dad is completely colorblind. He has no idea. So I just keep that in mind.
I've actually helped my sighted relatives with colors before. It's really...
Yeah, just do keep that in mind. And try to be understanding with these people. Because they might not even realize they're colorblind. Now we'll go over some common connectivity issues. If a wired client is unable to connect, the very first thing to do is check the cables. Is it plugged in? A bad or disconnected cable is the most common reason a wired device experiences connectivity problems. Make sure you're using the correct type of cable. For computer to computer, use a crossover cable. For connecting a switch or router, make sure to use a straight-through cable. So, if you've got crossover cables, they're not nearly as common as your straight-through cables in most of our lives. We might want to put a little twisty around them, or make sure they have a different feel of casing, or rubber band, or take a braille label, put C for crossover cable, wrap it around your cable.
Or some rough packing tape.
anything you want. Just you want to keep them separate because you cannot tell the difference by feel, usually, unless they have different casing on them, which mine did. Make sure your cables do not exceed the maximum distance requirement. Does anyone know the maximum distance requirement for Cat5 and Cat5e cable? This is in your test.
15 meters, all right?
No.
No.
No, hello? Not 100 feet.
Isn't it 50?
Keep guessing, people.
You're close, though. I think I know what you're trying to say. It's actually 100 meters, or 300 feet.
328 feet, or 100 meters. You have to know it's 100 meters or 328 feet. That's important. 100 meters or 328 feet. You don't have to know it's 328 feet unless you live in America, but you do need to know it's 100 meters if you live in the rest of the world.
Make sure that the correct ports are being used to connect two devices. On newer routers, this is not as much of an issue, but you won't usually get internet if a PC is plugged into your uplink port. I've done it. I've messed it up. On newer routers, some of them can be a little more forgiving, but really, guys, try and make sure that you've got them plugged into the right ports, just to save yourself that troubleshooting step.
Also, if you have routers that have a LAN and a WAN port, if you connect some things onto the LAN port and some things onto the another thing onto the WAN port, your router will often do network address translation between LAN and WAN by default. So sometimes if you're actually sticking lots of access points together, you do not want to be using the WAN ports. You want to be using LAN ports to daisy chain them together.
Don't run your cables where they are in danger of being stepped on, rolled over by your chair, or otherwise damaged. So cable along the wall, put the cables behind your desk, whatever you want to do. Try not to run cables across your floor. I mean, you can do it, but it's just going to get your cables damaged quickly, and you're going to have to buy new ones and recable everything. Okay. If you think a cable is damaged, and you have another one that you know works, switch out the good one with the bad one, because it's very difficult for us to tell if a cable is improperly terminated on the inside. So that's going to be your best bet to test cables. If a wireless device is unable to connect to an access point, there are probably wireless connectivity issues. Yeah, you'd think. Wireless connections use radio frequency signals to connect, so there are quite a few factors that can affect their ability to connect. There are several wireless standards, and not all standards are compatible. For example, a device that runs on the A standard may not be compatible with a B standard because they are on different frequencies. Make sure your wireless device and routers are working on the same standard. So, if you've got a device that is a B, and your router is in N-only mode, that device is not going to work with that router.
Another gotcha that we came across the other day is by default, a lot of wireless cards will only let you see channels 1 through 10. So if you have a wireless access point that's sitting on channel 13, you're not going to be able to see it. And that's something to be aware of in operating systems. Depending on your regional settings, you cannot see all 14 channels.
Don't most wireless routers default to 11?
Depends on the wireless router and the region setting. You can have 1 to 11, but if your access point's on 12, that's not going to help you.
Yep.
Many routers allow you to change the standards that they're using. So you'll just go in and you'll change it to B, B, G, and N, and then your device may work.
However, if you have only N devices, it is more efficient to only turn on the N support because having the backwards compatibility does slow down your wireless network.
Something I liked about Tomato was that you could scan the channels and it would tell you if there are any other wireless routers from your neighbors running on other channels, so you could just pick the one that was empty.
The regular Linksys firmware lets you scan as well, and so does DDWRT, OpenWRT, certainly does.
Oh.
Talking about the channels, each conversation needs to happen on a separate non-overlapping channel. Some APs can be, most APs can be configured to work on the channel and find the channel with the least amount of noise or highest amount of throughput. Although automatic settings work, manual setting of the AP channel provides greater control and may be necessary in some environments. Like ours, we want all of our wireless access points to be on the same channel so you can seamlessly roam. So all of ours are on 11. Okay, this makes some sense. The farther away from an access point, the weaker the signal is to that device. Kind of like an FM radio. If you're driving in a car and you're driving away, the farther away you get from the radio station or the city, the weaker the signal's going to get until it drops out. That's going to be the same thing with the wireless access points. If the device is too far away, the connection will become flaky and then finally drop out altogether. Outside interference can cause noise on a wireless connection. If there's too much noise, the connection may become unstable. So 2.4 GHz phones in the United States can actually interfere with wireless networks. That's why they're phasing them out. The more devices that connect to a wireless access point, the less bandwidth each device gets. Eventually, too many devices on one access point will slow the network to a crawl. So you may need to add another access point to put more devices onto your network.
Also, some access points have a 31 station limit. It's not generally put in the documentation and stuff, but some of them have a 31 station limit.
Is it possible to sort of have a ballpark estimation of how many, say G, because it's the most common standard equipment, devices that connect would, I've screwed up that sentence, but before it causes slow.
Depends on how often the devices are sending and receiving data.
If your network's slow and you've got a lot of devices on it, this is actually a question on one of the labs, what you do is to possibly add another workstation. Actually, maybe that was in my networking too.
Don't you mean another
yes,
access
another
point.
Access point.
That yeah, if it's going means. Slow and it's got lots of workstations, let's add another workstation.
Well, if it goes slower, you know what?
No, I think that's advanced networking in ITE1, so you guys get to play with some of that. The other main category of problems with wireless access points is configuration issues, and this is huge and usually one of your problems. Incorrect configuration of security settings will stop a client from connecting to the wireless access point. Also, some devices, especially PDAs that are older, are not compatible with higher levels of security methods, such as WPA. Before you implement a security method, make sure that all of the devices you want to connect to the access point work with that particular method. Make sure the SSID matches on the client's access point and the access point. If the SSID is broadcast, this is not an issue because you're connecting to that SSID and it will match.
It can be, actually. If you actually override the SSID in the client and you don't scan for it, you can still mess it up, so make sure they match. There are actually some wireless configuration utilities, such as the Cisco configuration utility and the Atheros configuration utility, that let you set up configuration profiles where you actually specify the SSID.
I have a question, Grace.
Go ahead.
I was wondering how do I get around WEP security when I am connected to a network at this place that I go to during the day, because they use WEP, and every time I enter in a website address, it asks me for a username and password, and it won't let me remember the password.
Is that by design?
That's not web security. That's security on their proxy server or something, and that's something specific to that place. Web security involves a networking key, which is usually either 10 or 26 hexadecimal digits, or a passphrase that converts into that.
We don't teach hacking into networks here.
Yeah, and it would really depend on the systems that those people ran as to why it wanted the username and password and stuff. It could be something to do with their proxy server, or it could be something to do with something else, so, yeah.
It sounds like some kind of weird security on a proxy server, yeah.
Yeah, just so that you know, WEP is something that you enter when you're accessing your wireless network. It'll ask you for a key, and you type it in there, and that's what WEP is. But yeah, if you're trying to browse the internet and it asks you for a password, that'd be...
That is absolutely annoying. What version of... do you have a password on your laptop, Paul?
Yes, I do. I do have a password on my laptop, but the problem is... This computer that in order to access this network at this place, I have to install a piece of inaccessible software called AT&T Communications Manager, and it gets really complicated.
Sounds like a bunch of security nightmare, but yeah, we wouldn't be able to help you hack into that network or anything.
Oh, okay, because I just... That's why the connection keeps dropping in and out over there.
Fair enough. Okay. If security is enabled, which it should be, make sure the client has the correct key. If it doesn't, it will be unable to connect to the access point. If the physical connection to the wired or wireless host appears to be connecting as expected, then you want to check the IP configuration of the client. Go to your wireless router status page and make sure you are actually connected to your ISP. If you see an IP address of 0.0.0.0 or no IP address at all, you are not connected. Release and renew your IP address on the router if possible. If not, you want to go down. You want to unplug that router and wait 30 seconds and pray. That should reset your router, and hopefully you will have internet connection back. If you do have an IP address from your... Go ahead.
Oh yeah, if your IP address is 169.254.whatever, then you're not connected.
You're not going to get that on the router side. A router cannot have a private IP address. At least I don't think it can.
Yes, it can. A router could be sitting behind another network address translator, so you could have plugged a router into a corporate network, and it would be assigned a private corporate address and sitting behind another router. So, yeah, routers can have a private IP address on their WAN.
Set up that way. Yeah.
I believe when I saw a 169, the reason why I knew I wasn't connected to the internet, even though I saw that, was because I believe it said auto configuration IP.
Yeah, that's different from internal IPs. We're talking about, like, Grace was asking, could you have like a 192.168 address on the WAN port of a router, and you can. But yeah, it would say auto configuration IP address. Why?
Because my my modem is from AT&T, and they want you to log in with PPPoE, and I decided rather than put the modem in bridged mode, it would be a lot quicker if I just told the router that I wanted it to be on 192.168.2.1.
Except you've got a double layer of NAT.
And then it works.
Yeah, so now you've got a double layer of NAT, which means forwarding ports becomes infinitely more difficult, and you're more likely to fill up your connection tables, especially if you torrent, which of course, probably don't. I'd put the AT&T in bridge mode and hand it through, because it probably gets slightly faster.
Yeah. I
you were saying you were having problems with your speeds as well, and that you weren't getting the same speeds. Well, that might be why.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, it's around... Yeah, I need to do another test, but yeah, I suppose that's possible.
Alright. Once you're set your router and pray, if you do have an IP address from your ISP, open a command prompt and type ipconfig/all and make sure the settings such as the default gateway and DNS servers match. Also make sure you are on the same LAN segment as your default gateway on the router that you have.
How much more have you got? It's 11:03.
Okay. I don't have very much more at all. We're almost done. If you're not, release and renew your IP address from the command prompt as discussed earlier. If that doesn't work, you may have to reconfigure your router and or computer to use the correct default gateway or LAN segment. I had a problem with a couple of my routers. I was doing double DHCP, so half the time it worked and half the time it didn't, and I had to fix that on my router side. If the computers on the network can connect to each other but not the internet, it is probably a problem between your router and the ISP. As stated before, go to the router's status page and make sure the connection is active. If it isn't and you're unable to establish connectivity, you're going to need to contact your ISP to report the problem. We talk about documentation. Again, documentation is a good thing. You want to, when you install a new network, run a baseline test and see how fast your network is running when it is running optimally and how much load it can take. I believe there's software that you can use to do this. My baseline test in America was to go to Freedom Scientific's website and download JAWS and see how fast it went.
So, when the website runs slow, blame Grace.
Yeah, I suck. But that's what I did.
I would seriously find a speed test site or something that is a bigger mirror site, such as FileHippo or something, because
obviously is good. It's accessible for that.
Yeah, that works fairly well.
Yeah, I do speed test now, but at one point I don't believe it was accessible. So remember to document the actual problem. You want to document steps taken to isolate the problem, results of all steps taken, both successful and unsuccessful, and the final determined cause of the problem and its solution. Also, preventative measures to make sure the problem does not happen again. And this will help your future troubleshooting endeavors go a lot more smoothly. Remember that it is okay to ask for help. If you cannot figure out the answer to a problem on your own, it's perfectly reasonable to research it. The first place you might want to go is the manufacturer's website for any router problems. And the next place you might want to go is Google and put in the model number and manufacturer of the router.
That's assuming you've got network connectivity, and I always have a big chuckle when modern technicians go into a jelly mess when they lose internet connectivity, because, hey, we can't research anything without the internet.
Bring a dongle, guys.
Or learn to troubleshoot without the internet. For blind people, it's not too cool, but believe it or not, routers come with printed documentation. Handy stuff, that.
Actually, a lot of routers have PDFs on the CDs.
Yeah, and you hope that your client has that information. If you're working in a company with other technicians, you can always ask them. Maybe they had experience with this problem and might be able to help you. And of course, always keep a copy of your documentation technical journal, because you forget what problems you've solved eventually. And you can look them up, and maybe you've solved this problem before and you've completely forgotten about it, and there is your solution right there in your notes. Make sure to be organized when calling if you've got to report a problem to a help desk. Make sure to be organized, be patient with them, and humor them by trying the steps if you can, if you have time, because they're just trying to do their job. Don't abuse them. They're only human. And that is the end of our lecture. Any questions? Okay, so I have a question for you guys. Would anyone benefit from practice with a few of these troubleshooting tools? Would anyone like me to actually write up a lab? It's sort of a democracy. But not really. So any feedback on that?
Would I like to do more work?
I tend not to give the students a choice. If we set the lab, they have to do it. There's no democracy about it.
Well, no, but if anyone has any feedback of anything they want me to include...
Well, the fact is we're going to replace a number of inaccessible labs that you can't do with a lab that you can do, so there's certainly value in that. So if there's anything people particularly want us to cover in that lab, let us know. But yes, you will be doing a lab. That is not optional.
So right now we can't do any of the 9 labs?
Yeah, 9 is pretty much stuff you can't do. So okay. Me or Carrie will probably write up a new one.
Okay.
Is there anything anyone wants, especially wants practice on, though? And if you don't want to say it out here, you can totally write to CAVI instructors within the next day or so. Anything anyone thinks they've had enough of and that they're good on?
This is for troubleshooting problems with network connectivity?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, and by the way, Grace, I did find that wide tip. I got it straightened out.
Oh,
the
good.
Calculator. I hit the X key and it gave me a... Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, fair enough.
No, X is actually 10 to the power of X, and Y is X to the Y. They are actually different keys.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Carrie.
All right, then, guys. If nobody has anything they want or don't want in this lab, then cool. I'll just figure out some stuff to write up for you, and you'll have some exercises coming up. Thank you.
All right, I'm hitting stop.